developmental optometrist, award-winning author, and international speaker, Dr. Lynn Hellerstein holds powerful and inspiring conversations with her guests on Vision Beyond Sight in areas of healthcare, wellness, education, sports, and psychology. They share their inspirational stories of healing and life transformation through their vision expansion. Billions of people have vision problems, and vision is more than 20/20. Vision Beyond Sight will help you see with clarity and gain courage and confidence. Your vision does not define you. You define your vision. With Dr. Lynn's new way to look at your life through a new lens, you will be ready to meet yourself and receive visualizations for miracles to come. Welcome to Vision Beyond Sight.
Hi friends, this is Dr. Lynn and welcome to Vision Beyond Sight. Today visiting with us is my friend, Dr. Guy Maital. Today we're going to talk about mental well-being and creating a new context for mental health. Let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Maital's very impressive and adventurous life. Dr. Guy Maital is dedicated to emotional well-being and psychological freedom for all people, and particularly for people experiencing severe medical illness. He currently serves as Forge Health's Chief of Integrated Care and Psychiatric Services. In this role, he is leading Forge Health's initiatives to provide the highest quality care to clients with coexisting medical conditions and to enhance the interface of Forge Health's mental health and substance use services with medical specialties, including primary care medicine, oncology, and others. He also has a private psychiatric practice as part of his mission to create a new context for mental health. Most recently, Dr. Maital served as Chief of Integrated Care and Psychiatric Oncology at New York Presbyterian from 2018 to 2023, and he also spent 11 years on the faculty of Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School, where he served in several leadership positions, including medical director of psychiatry ambulatory services. Dr. Maital has written widely in the areas of clinical expertise, and he's authored and co-authored peer-reviewed papers, review articles, and book chapters in various areas of psychosomatic medicine. He's a dedicated and passionate teacher who's committed to training early career clinicians, as well as the ongoing education of practicing clinicians. Dr. Maital was educated at Harvard College and Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and he currently lives in New York City. So welcome to Vision Beyond Sight, Dr. Maital. It's just great to have you today.
Thank you today, Dr. Lynn. So great. Thank you for having me.
Yes. And, you know, we know each other at a whole different level through some personal development courses, which have been great. And reading your bio is quite impressive. And we've talked a little bit about mental health care, which is your whole career. So let's kind of get started. What brought you to the field of psychiatry and not only psychiatry, to working with people who have medical illnesses and need psychiatric kinds of help?
Well, thanks for asking the question. When I got to medical school, I realized that the only thing I really could do was psychiatry, because I'd always been interested in the wholeness of a human being. Before getting to medical school, I had many, many different interests, everything from science to history to psychology to literature and all just really the full expanse of the human condition. And when I got to medical school, it was clear, well, the specialty that does that the most readily and most frequently is psychiatry, because we can look at a person's neuron, or we can look at the entirety of a society that shapes a person's emotional and psychological well-being through social determinants of health and everything in between. So that was the big reason. You know, like, there are lots of ways to describe a career path. One is, I stood here, I wanted to go there, and I went. I find that that's pretty rare for most people. It's I stood here and I thought about this thing 3 feet in front of me, and that looked interesting. And then I went 2 more feet in front of me, and then I went left, and then I went right, and then, oh, look where I wound up. The thing that pulled me forward was in the world of medical illness is the experience I had as a student meeting people when they were in the hospital grappling with the ramifications of having an illness. And there were several, and most doctors will tell you that there are several really key experiences that I had with specific patients that I'll never get over that really shaped my thinking about what I wanted to do with a career. There was one patient in particular that I would just spend a lot of time with in the hospital, and she had a chronic illness, and she had a book. She was older, and she had a book called How to Get Out of the Hospital Alive that she kept at her bedside, and she made her primary care doctor sign. He was not the author, but she and I actually became friends because she was frequently admitted to the hospital. And just she opened my eyes to thinking about the patient's experience as a human being grappling with all the physical changes that illness provides. The challenge we have in our conceptualization is the word patient has a deep implication of passivity. And that's one of the things that I think people struggle with and struggle against, both on the medical side and on when we are sick. All doctors are patients at some point. So for all those reasons, I wound up loving internal medicine, loving psychiatry, and found a way to navigate a career that was at the interface of both.
Well, Dr. Maytel, I love that a special connection with other medical illnesses, because having some serious medical problems myself 21 years ago when I had a tumor in my colon, and the fear of the surgery, the fear of cancer, but even the bigger fear of being home alone in recovery really put me in quite the state. And I had nobody to talk to about. Certainly at that point in time, I personally wasn't the type of person that would bring it up in casual conversation. And the few times I mentioned it to my doctor, it was pretty much put aside, and it was all about the medical procedure. And so I think there's such an open area and need for people in the hospital, how to empower them and take charge of their health, even though they can't control the illness necessarily. Maybe mention some of the kinds of things that would be very helpful for a patient who is ill. Because I know for me personally, fear, and we could list all the fears, but fear is one of the primary emotions I turn to when I'm not well.
For sure. You know, I think one of the challenges is there's so much we could talk about. So we'll just see where this takes us. I think one of the challenges is that for a person who regards themselves as healthy, to become sick or to develop an illness is a major existential change. It's a major change in your relationship to your body, to that which we take for granted. Most people who regard themselves as well don't question whether or not their legs will work when they wake up in the morning. I mean, we may complain about, a stiff back or something like that and hit snooze a few times, but none of us are wondering, where will my arm work to hit the snooze button? We just take it for granted that it does, except one day it doesn't. One day something happens. And the something that happens is unexpected. It's either some experience that you have that is unexpected and undesirable, that is an out of the norm. And the technical term for that is a symptom. We generally don't think about what does the word symptom mean, but it means some physical experience that is out of the norm and undesirable. So it's pain, it's something doesn't work the way you expect it to work. And then people do one of two things, they address it or they ignore it until it's unignorable. Part of all of that is connected to that fear that you were just mentioning, fear of what this physical experience, the symptom means. Does it mean And most of us have symptoms, by the way, all the time. We have pain here and a little twitch there and a headache here and numbness there for a few minutes. And we mostly categorize these symptoms as within the range of normal, and we dismiss them. It's really when we stop dismissing them, either because we can't ignore them anymore or they go beyond the scope of what we think is normal, then the fear kicks in. And then the question is, okay, what do I do with it? And how do I talk about it? Then there's this whole transition period where you go from experience to diagnosis. So you have some experience, you have a pain in your stomach and you go to the doctor and the doctor says, oh, it's a stomach virus. It will go away in 2 days. That might have you be a lot less afraid because somebody who's seen this has said something about it. Or they might say, oh, this is new. We should examine this further. That might make the fear worse, the uncertainty worse. So it's part of it is all of the change that happens. And once you're dealing with a severe or persistent medical illness, the thing that you rely on, namely the stability of your body to do what it normally does or what you expect it to do, that becomes less and less reliable. There are all these changes that happen, and there are times of tremendous change, and our minds can't keep up. And that leads to tremendous anxiety. I think one of the challenges is what you pointed to, which is that medical providers are generally trained to address the medical issues. You know, nobody takes a test in medical school on communication. I wish they did, but most, I don't know if nobody, but there may be a few places where people are, but the vast majority don't have significant investment in communication training. You're rewarded for knowledge and pattern recognition and being able to physically intervene where appropriate. So it leaves a lot of people, as you were just describing in your own experience, feeling alone. Like wondering, how do I talk about this? Who do I talk about this with?
Right. And the whole barometer of what's normal, you know, when people say, how are you feeling? And I might be feeling a little better, but I'm really feeling bad overall. And so I lost perspective of even what to tell people. How am I feeling? Fine. You know, the normal response. But the whole barometer shifts for that. And there may be some days that I feel so much better. I'm excited that, again, you know, compared to a regular day, I may not feel well, but I'm just so excited because it's a good day. And so even the whole play of communication changes because our barometer has shifted.
Completely. And when people have a serious medical illness, like dealing with tumor or cancer, I mean, context is everything. If you're talking to someone who is an Olympic athlete and they say, how are you feeling? They might say, you know, my hamstring's a little off. But this is someone who's in peak physical performance, peak physical health. If you're talking to someone who has a serious medical illness, someone who's dealing with a serious cancer, for example, if you know that, that question means something very different than if you're ignorant of it. Like if you just met someone and say, how are you feeling today? And you have no idea what they're dealing with.
Right.
The challenge, I think, is for people dealing with medical illness, folks around them don't know how to talk about it. Cancer is very scary, but so are other chronic illnesses. Mostly what I tell people who are ill is people in your life, their job, they'll say things like, you know, the people in my life, my loved ones, my friends, my colleagues, they just don't get it. And they're often quite frustrated that the people in their life don't get it. And over the years, my response has evolved into some version of, well, it's not their job. Their job is to support you and love you. They're probably never going to get it. How could they? They're not in your shoes. Your job is to teach them how to talk to you about it. And that really does, that's a shift from the way most people operate, I think. Most people will kind of passively expect the folks in their lives to know what to say and then be disappointed, frustrated, or even upset when they don't say the quote unquote right thing.
Oh, I see that happening all the time, not just in an illness, but just in general. You can't read my mind how bad I feel.
Of course. But, you know, I think when we're sick, we just feel bad.
Yeah.
And we regress at times to, I just want my mom, dad, grandmother, grandfather to take care of me. Like my pastor, my rabbi, my imams, they ought to know what to say. At least these folks ought to know what to say. And I think that empowering people who are patients to take a more active role in communication, in asking questions, in telling people, here's what I need you to say. When I, one of the things, for example, and it doesn't end when the cancer is over, because the illness may be in remission or the tumor may be excised, but you're still dealing with the repercussion. Most people around the sick, we're so not used to, at least in the United States, we're so not used to being around sick people. We have this illusion of perfect health, and so we don't know what to say. Mostly they're scared the Jesus out of us. So when someone around you has serious illness, unless they're like your close relative, mostly what you're thinking about is yourself. If we're intellectually honest, it's like, oh, I feel bad for them, but I hope what's it going to be for me when I'm like this? And this person serves as a reminder of my own frailty or my own mortality. You know, we are, a turn of phrase I heard that I've stolen is, we are the temporary immortals. We live like we're going to live forever. And we know we're temporary. When an illness shows up in our circle, oh my goodness, it's a reminder that, oh, this is all temporary. And so people will say things like, oh, you know, the cancer is over. You must be great now.
Right.
When this person is dealing with chronic symptoms or the emotional repercussions of trying to reintegrate back into life or grieving a loss of function, a loss of a job, a loss of relationship, a loss of money. Being sick in the United States is a very expensive proposition. So the dismissal of it is also part and parcel of the way we communicate about loss and grief. And we expect people to get over major losses pretty quickly. Like, you know, your parent died last week. You should be back at work. Right. And let's not talk about it.
You know, I see that so often in my patient load. We see a lot of patients that have sustained concussions. Mm. And concussions are the hidden illness where Indeed. People often look fine. They may talk okay, but they've yeah. lost energy. They've lost flexibility, endurance, just all these other things that it looks like just try harder would fix. And right. this can go on the rest of their life. But one of the things I've seen with many of the patients I see have been high achievers, you know, top athletes or CEOs that have been involved in car accidents. So the grieving is often a loss of a big job or income yeah. or leadership. And people still see them as highly functional, so they don't understand that loss. But occasionally there's an opportunity for people, if they'll work through that loss, of finding some, I call them silver linings, for lack of better words, of change careers, change the way they live life, that they don't work all the time. How often do you see, you know, you hate it when you're sick, when people go, well, there's a silver lining to your illness. And you go, well, show me that. You know, I don't believe it.
I know.
During the pain, you don't see it. But how often, if people will really deal with their emotions, do people come out on the other side of in a different place? Maybe may or may not be better, but it's a new life that they've created for themselves.
I mean, it actually can happen pretty often if the person is willing to engage in a process. You know, when people are already coming to see us, it's a self-selective group of people who are willing to participate in something that might make their lives better. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an old joke about how many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb? Only one, but it has to want to change. So does this happen quite a bit? Often not in the ways that people expect. I think that it really does depend on several factors. It depends on if people have, and I'm thinking about severe medical illness, especially things that, like, I work with people who have cancer or neurological illnesses. Strangely enough, if the illness is moving really fast, people don't have time to breathe. So they're just, you know, holding on to the guardrail to not fall out of the car as it's moving really quickly. Mm-hmm. For illnesses where there's more that are either slower in terms of their progression or get better, go into remission, et cetera, there is more time to breathe and more time to feel and more time to think. For some people, it's the period of time after the acute treatment when they have, for the first time, they're just looking at life and saying, oh, wait, what's the impact on my life of this experience and how can I integrate it meaningfully? There are a lot of people who find silver lining. I mean, silver lining is, even that's not the term I might use. It's more because that implies that the middle is dark. Mm-hmm. It's more, no, this is my life now. And how do I make sense of it in a way that's fulfilling? It happens all the time. People find that the folks in their life are, turns out to be super supportive. I have more intimacy with the people in my life. Or they reassess their values and they choose to work less, have a different career that's more expressive of what's important to them. Or they just find a deeper spiritual connection, either in a general way or a deeper connection to their professed faith. Things of that sort happen pretty frequently. And even during treatment, people, you know, when people are dealing with crisis, it is, in my experience, a rare thing that they will have one of these powerful moments of insight or an epiphany. Mostly we go to what has worked in the past because we're in survival mode. So if you're someone who hunkers down and kind of puts their head under their blanket and hopes the world will leave you alone, then often that's what people do. And they find that it's not a very effective coping mechanism in the long run. In the short run, it's actually pretty good. But avoidance is a terrible coping mechanism long term. For people who are more deal with things by being open, by asking for help, those folks tend to do better during crises.
And that's a great, important message to tell your patients, to tell your family members, and allow for that as a family member. Allowing that openness is really the job of the family member. Not telling them what to do, but to allow that person to be open, which we all want to fix things and find the solution. But allowance is a big deal. Yeah. Dr. Maytal, we're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll talk more about creating a new context for mental health.
Dr. Lynn will be right back after this. Can your child see, really see, more than 20/20? Does your child struggle in school, have trouble with tracking when reading, or resist writing? Dr. Lynn Hellerstein's award-winning book, See It, Say It, Do It, provides parents and teachers with specific tools and strategies in visualization and processing. Improve and empower your child's learning and performance in school, sports, and play. Get See It, Say It, Do It on Amazon or visit lynnhellerstein.com. Dr. Lynn Hellerstein's book, 50 Tips to Improve Your Sports Performance, has identified the top 50 ways for you to achieve excellent results in any sport activity. Enhance eye-mind-body coordination skills, achieve the mental edge, prevent injuries. This book belongs in every athlete's or coach's sports bag. Get 50 Tips to Improve Your Sports Performance on Amazon or visit lynnhellerstein.com. Welcome back to Vision Beyond Sight. Here's Dr. Lynn.
Welcome back. We're here with Dr. Guy Maytal, and we're talking about mental well-being and creating a new context for mental health. So let's continue on our conversation about psychiatric diagnoses. I know there's a stigma for a lot of people even to think about seeing anybody in the mental health field, much less have a psychiatric type of diagnosis. You know, what don't people understand about it? And, you know, if they knew, they'd be more empowered to live their life.
Yeah. So let's take a step back from it. It's a great question because there is a fundamental misunderstanding about what a diagnosis is. And that extends to medicine, by the way. This isn't like the secret the doctors haven't been keep telling you. This is most doctors don't understand what a diagnosis is. Diagnosis is not an object. It's not a thing like a table or a cup or a computer. It doesn't exist anywhere except in language. It is a tool used in language that is very useful. The mistake people make is thinking that a diagnosis is a thing. You know, people say like, I have heart disease, like they have heart disease in the same way that they have a car, except it really isn't that way. So I'll tell you, a diagnosis is a tool in language that lets you do three things. First, it lets you be sure that more or less you're talking about the same thing or same collection of experiences that someone else would be talking about if they saw this. Or, you know, a patient shows up in a doctor's office in Tokyo, whatever they're going to call it in Tokyo, if they showed up in a doctor's office in New York City, they would pretty much call it the same thing. So you can talk about the same thing. Because what's walking in is a human being who's got a set of experiences that they're worried about. And then the medical system does whatever examinations, whatever observations in the physical exam, using blood labs, using imaging. You put all that together and someone says, aha, this fits a pattern. And we call this pattern thyroid cancer. And that's not even a real diagnosis. Thyroid cancer is way more, there are way more subdivisions, but let's use that as a random example. So all of a sudden everyone goes, okay, if I'm in Tokyo, if I'm in New York, if I'm in London, we're all going to call it the same thing. The other thing a diagnosis lets you do is predict what's likely to happen or what are the range of probable paths this could take. You know, it's not likely that your foot's going to fall off if you have thyroid cancer. So we can not have to worry about that. So we can say, okay, we're all talking about the same thing, and there are like these 17 different paths that this can take, but it's not an infinite number. And the last thing a diagnosis lets you do is intervene in some way to change those probable paths. Oh, given that these are the 17 things that could happen, here's what we could do to either make them less severe or prevent them from happening in the first place. And that's it. That's what it is. It's not the truth. It's not like this is really thyroid cancer, which is a weird thing to say. I know people are like, what are you talking about? But here's what I'm talking about. For 2000 years or more in Europe and the Mediterranean, they had a system for organizing illness that started with Hippocrates and went through this Alexandrian physician named Galen, using these four humors, four fluids of the human body. That's how they conceptualized it, like your humors were balanced or imbalanced. And the mistake that every generation makes is thinking the people in the past were somehow less smart than we are. These are brilliant people, and this system worked for them for 2,000 years. You might go to a doctor and say, you have too much bile. We have to figure out a way to rebalance your choler. That's where the word choleric or bilious comes from. So that's what we would do. And they would say, oh, you know, you have an imbalance of the humors. And you go home and tell your spouse, oh, I have this humor imbalance. Go, that sounds really serious. He goes, yeah, but they're going to help me. Today, we might call it thyroid cancer. Is one more true than the other? No, they're just linguistic tools. Except our current linguistic tools allow us to predict and intervene better than those linguistic tools. It's the same phenomenon. You could even look today at contemporary experiences of Ayurvedic medicine or Chinese medicine. Are those things less true, more true? They're different tools that allow you to do different things. The reason I say that is with mental illness in particular, at least in English, we talk about it in a very weird way. We talk about it as if the person is the diagnosis. It's not enough to think the diagnosis is a physical thing, which is obviously not the case. Now you kind of get where I'm pointing. But no one says, I am breast cancer. People do say, I am bipolar. She is schizophrenic. I am depressed. And when you are a thing, there's not much you could do about it. Or it takes tremendous effort to change it. You know, I am a human being. If I wish to not be a human being, that would take a huge amount of effort to not be a human being. I mean, maybe you could change it. I have no idea. Probably not. But if you say, I am bipolar disorder, then what do? You survive it. Or, frankly, you argue that you're not. So for a lot of people, psychiatric diagnoses are really arguments pretending to be something else.
Wow, that's really beautifully said. And both
if
personal...
I one,
go
just,
ahead.
If I could add one more thing, just one other thing. So for both physical illness as well as mental illness, these things evolve because their linguistic construct, they evolve. So some person, it's pretty often, not often, from time to time it happens that someone will see a doctor and the doctor will say, oh, what you're dealing with is X. And you go, maybe, and you go for a second opinion and they'll say, what you're dealing with is Y. And you go for a third opinion and that doctor, usually that's the guru on the mountain, and they'll say, oh, really what you've got is this QXZ thing that, and you go, oh, those other two doctors, they were just stupid and wrong, which is, again, not the most helpful way to hold that. Rather, what happened is an evolution, and the third guru on the mountain has the benefit of that experience and the thing evolving over time. Same with mental illness. People will say, well, you know, that doctor says I'm bipolar, I'm really not, I'm like this, blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, you're learning over time. The system is learning based on your experience, which one of these linguistic categories works best for your experience. And it's a dance. And that's where we as people who are patients, as much as people who are in the medical system, have a responsibility to say, you know what, let's keep partnering to sort this out, because I want to figure out what I have rather than, especially with mental illness, figure out who I am, which is not the case at all. And I think that's the source of a lot of the stigma. It's much easier to deal with something that I have. You know, I have a pair of pants, I might want to change them. So that's what I wanted just to add to that.
Yeah, that's such an important piece. I am is the strong statement of intention. You are declaring yourself who you are. And so I am bipolar. You know, that's the declaration of what we've created to live into. And I have this little teaching lesson argument with people in my office all the time when they're talking about patient. Oh, he's a TBI. He's a cerebral patient. And I go, no, he's not a TBI. He's a patient with a TBI. They go, what's the difference? And the difference I learned personally is huge. When somebody finally said to me, when I had all my medical problems 21 years ago and we had surgery to remove part of my colon, became allergic to all foods, I was living through the lens of a bad colon, a sick colon, one who can't digest. Mm. And somebody said to me, you know, you're not your colon.
Mm.
And it took me aback for a minute. What do you mean I'm not my colon? That is what I created. I am my bad colon. And so I did it even in a physical illness, not just a mental illness. And the mindset that created for me was I saw everything through sickness. All my language changed. I couldn't, you know, digest life. This is a bunch of shit. This is, you know, all my language was through the digestive system of a colon. And when I understood that, that was so empowering for me that I have this issue I need to deal with. But that's not who I am, and I still can create who I am. And so thanks so much for bringing that distinction up. And that kind of takes me to the next step, because I think that's where people create their narratives from, you know, identifying they are their illnesses. but I want to talk to you about helping people or people looking for help through creating either intentions or meditation or prayer. What impact did those kinds of resources have on people's mental well-being?
I'll give you the least useful answer, which is, of course, it depends. But that having been said, I think that they can, if you are someone who is willing to try that on or already have a practice, it can be incredibly helpful. I think that I'm going to speak to, because people who already have a prayer practice or a meditation practice, for them, it's part of their self-care, part of how they ground themselves, part of how they engage with life. So it's obviously incredibly helpful. Otherwise, they wouldn't have continued it. And they're likely, and for people who do that, I strongly encourage them to continue it. And they don't need to be told that. Usually they're already doing it. Although at times I will inquire, are there things that you do or have done to help yourself feel better? And they'll say, oh yeah, I used to meditate every day, but I stopped since the chemotherapy started. And I gently invite them to pick that up again. And they often do, and it's helpful because they know how to do it, and it has been helpful. But when people come and ask, who've never done anything like that, is that something I should do, or would that be useful to me? I have a two-part answer. One is, it certainly can be. And the second part is, you have to come at it with a lot of kind of room to be however you are. You're about to start something that you've never done before. And if people, you know, adults are kind of funny. Children don't expect to be masters of things when they're first learning them. Like, you know, a child learning how to play piano is not expecting to be able to play Tchaikovsky. But adults, we're kind of funny. We try a thing. If we're not really, really good at it after the first 10 minutes, often we just stop. Or we'll say, well, that didn't work. Same with things like meditation or prayer or intention. It's a practice. And I remind people that they're just starting out and that they really got to be really kind to themselves as they're starting it out. And it's going to be kind of clunky and they'll feel stupid and this doesn't work. And I'm like, yep, that's how it goes. And it's giving people the space to experience that. We talk about beginner's mind like it's an universally pleasant experience. Like, there's the world of beginner's mind is fraught with anxiety and worry about doing it right.
Yes, right.
So that's how you know you're in the beginner's mind. You're like, I don't know what the heck I'm doing here. I worry. The other thing I worry about is it's developed. There's a term now in the field. They call it toxic positivity. That's the kind of, if you take that notion of staying upbeat to its extreme, there are people who will say things like, well, you got to stay positive, otherwise your illness will get worse. Or some version of that. There are lots of different variations of that. And that, I think, is that extreme position can be quite damaging because it doesn't give people space to have the negative experiences, to have sadness and anger and frustration and fear and all of that. Because the moment, if you're living like, I have to stay positive and upbeat, then it's a double whammy. Because if you feel down, not only do you feel down, but you're now scared that your feeling down is going to make your illness worse. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in that domain. So just, again, giving people, as they're taking on practices to feel better, the space to have the negative experiences simply be part of what it is to be human dealing with an illness.
And then having community and people to share that with,
for sure,
is what I see the next step. And I know we have a friend that is just starting her second cancer battle. Mm. And every morning we have a call with six of us. Just to share,
yeah,
and to be open. And it started really on her cancer journey, just to be there to support when we didn't know what to say or what to do. just to let her know we were there. And it's now turned into a daily, 5 day a week event. And to see the power of community, just to be with that person, or, you know, each of us have our own stuff, just to have somebody be there to listen has just been such a gift.
Wow, indeed. That is such an act of generosity. That's incredible.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, it's really incredible. Yeah.
Dr. Bittal, we're running out of time here, and I'm going to ask you what's not a simple question and could take a whole nother podcast, but just to comment a couple minutes about your opinion and use of medications with psychiatric illnesses. And again, it could be depends, and I'm sure there's lots of variabilities, but give us a little overview if you could.
Yeah, a little overview. And it's like 2 minutes or less. Here's what I say. Nobody can think their way out of diabetes. And the challenge with mental illness is because it's a gradient of a spectrum of experience that interfaces or crashes head on to all sorts of cultural biases, meaning, there's depression could be just like, I feel sad today, but that's not the illness, major depressive disorder, which is a relapsing illness, people that comes and goes and is devastating to people's lives. The challenge is that people think that they know. Mental health care is one of these strange fields where people come with requesting the treatment rather than with the symptom half the time. You know, they'll say, oh, I want therapy, or say, I don't want meds. I was like, I don't know. You don't go to the cardiologist saying, you know, I don't want meds, I just want heart surgery. It's like, tell us where it hurts and let's see what we could do to help. Taking medications is a tool like any other. You can't think your way out of diabetes. You can't think your way out of bipolar illness.
Yeah.
And we've got, 100-year history of treatments that are increasingly better, and some of them are excellent. And frankly, if you look at the data, the degree of recovery from psychiatric illness is higher than almost any other medical illness out there, which is kind of funny. People think, oh, these are chronic illnesses that you never get better from. Just the opposite. Medication is a key component. That's as simple as I can say it. It's dealing with the stigma of it that gets in people's way.
Right.
It gets in their way of thinking clearly about what would actually be helpful here. I'll say one last thing, which is, there's so much meaning around these medications that people with cancer who are taking very toxic chemicals to treat their cancer often get very anxious, not at the chemotherapy, but at like the antidepressant medicine, which is a good opportunity to educate people. I'm like, no, this will help you. And these are some of the safest medicines out there. So I don't take it lightly, but it's certainly not something to be terribly concerned about. I'm certainly not more concerned about than any other type of medicine that you take for a chronic illness. Oh yeah, this is what I was going to say. Most medicine doesn't cure anything. Mostly as adults, we have chronic illnesses, blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease, kidney disease. These, we just manage them. We manage over time. There are very few things that medicine actually cures. Some surgical things, some infections, and that's really it. Everything else we manage, and mental illness is just one of those components.
Thank you very much for a loaded question with a very good answer. There's not one cure. It's you have a variety of tools and truly, you mentioned at the break your last kind of mantra and recommendation for people. You want to repeat what you were talking about? How you'd like to encourage our listeners?
Whatever. Personal growth work you want to do it before you get sick. Don't wait till you're sick or on your deathbed to try to grow up. It's not going to be that effective. If you want to deal powerfully with being sick, deal powerfully with being well and do the work now rather than waiting for some crisis to hit you.
Well said, and thank you so much for your time. For people interested in reaching you, you will have all that information on the show notes and your website, forgehealth.com. And Dr. Maital, it's just been a real pleasure speaking with you, and thank you so much for what you're doing for the world and what you're doing in the field of mental health. And I'm excited about your direction and looking forward to great things to come.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Lynn. It's really an honor and a privilege to be here speaking with you.
All right. And thanks, and we'll see all of you real soon. Bye-bye for now.
Thank you for joining us today on Vision Beyond Sight. Join Dr. Lynn Hellerstein each week to help you find clarity in your functional vision and expand the power of your seeing brain to gain courage, confidence, and success in your life. Remember, your vision does not define you. You define your vision. For more information and find additional podcasts, visit lynnhellerstein.com. See you next time on Vision Beyond Sight.